Dr. Anthony Lang is a reader in St. Andrew's own School of International Relations and director of the Center for Global Constitutionalism. Dr. Lang will be speaking to us this afternoon on the challenges to creating true political change in Egypt. Dr. Lang was formerly assistant professor of political science at the American University in Cairo, and as well as a program officer at the Carnegie Council for Ethics and International Affairs. He currently serves as co-editor of the new journal, Global Constitutionalism. Welcome, Dr. Lang.
Okay. All right, so as is, thank you. I haven't said anything yet, so you can't start clapping. I'm pretty loud, so I'm gonna try to project. I guess the microphone's not quite working, so let me know in the back if you can't hear me, but I think my voice will do it. So thank you for inviting me, and this is a terrific workshop or conference that the Foreign Affairs Society has put on. Thank you to Megan, who was in touch with me, and Max, who seems to be doing a lot of this organizing. This is a terrific student initiative. Really pleased to see that. I want to apologize for the fact that I wasn't here in the beginning, and I probably won't be here tomorrow as well. Just as when Megan told me the date that this was on, it was on a Saturday, and I have four little kids, and my wife looked at me when I said it's on a Saturday and just looked at me for a while. So that means I'm apologizing in advance because I'm glad I got to see Adham. My friend Adham's presentation was terrific, and I'm sorry I missed the other ones. And I'm sure the rest of the day tomorrow is going to be terrific. But I wish I could be here for it. I've got kind of different things in the program. It says that, you know, whenever you write an abstract for what you're going to talk about, it sometimes it changes as you think more about it, so it's changed a little bit, but it's still the same, and it says the word democratization in the program. I'm going to be talking about what I would call constitutionalism, which is I'm interested in constitutions and how constitutions relate to politics, so that's going to be my focus. And I'm speaking to you as someone with interests in the Middle East and having spent time in the Middle East and done work on the Middle East, but more with the interest of a political theorist. Adham was defending political science before, and I'm a political scientist, but I consider my work more political theory than anything else. So I'm going to be looking at things from a bit of what I would call a normative perspective, perhaps, but also trying to build in talking about some of the same things that Adham was talking about concerning revolutions and how they turn into constitutions or don't, and how that all comes about. And I'm going to focus in particular on Egypt, so it really will be one case study. And I know Fiona and Bill, I think tomorrow we're going to be talking a little bit more about Egypt. That'll be the one kind of case I'm going to be looking at. And I'm not so sure how much you can generalize from this one case more broadly, so as opposed to a series of case studies that prove a larger hypothesis, I would see Egypt more as an illustrative case about not just about the Middle East, not about the Arab world, but about politics. Because I think what we're witnessing now is just this terrific moment, this very exciting moment, in which we see, you know, a lot of interesting political developments happening. And so that's why I want to focus on how we understand and perhaps interpret some of those political developments, okay? And so I'm going to do that by starting off with a few big questions, giving you a kind of tentative answer, and then I'm going to just talk about three different things. One, security and the conflict between security and liberty. Second, revolution. And then third, constitutions, or actually more accurately, the word I'm going to use is constituent power, which is a kind of technical political theory term that I'll talk a little bit about and relate it to some of the events going on in Egypt today, but also, in part, Egypt's history as well, because I think, this is, as Adham nicely said, revolutions have been happening for a long time, not just in the Middle East, but for a long time everywhere. And so I think a bit of historical context is quite useful and quite important. And I'm sorry I missed my colleague Andy Williams' presentation, who I know holds the flag high for historians always. And he's a good friend, so I can tease him about that. I've got three big questions. These are the questions, and these are questions I'm in the midst of thinking about right now, doing some work on myself. So this is a kind of presentation that's in part of a larger project. I'm working a bit on this with my colleague in the school, Dr. Michelle Burgess, and we've been going back and forth and trying to do work on some of these themes for the past couple years, and the kind of all the events in the Arab world took us by surprise. We had another project that's changed into this newer project as a result. It's an ongoing set of questions we've been asking. But these are some of the ones I wanted to focus on with you today. Okay, so three big questions. First of all, does a revolution create freedom or insecurity? So and you could see both happening in Egypt right now. You can see this kind of flourishing of freedom, political liberty, very exciting. But you also see this kind of craziness, chaos, violence, things that we wouldn't see as such good things. Now, you know, the breakdown of any political order and a shift to a new political order inevitably leads to this kind of these two poles. You know, greater freedom, excitement, good thing, insecurity, bad thing. But that's not new. I mean, some of the, you know, the classical works in political theory, the classical debate, you could say, of the 17th century political thought between John Locke, Thomas Hobbes, you have this, Hobbes advocating for greater security, Locke advocating kind of for more liberty. So this is not a new conflict. It's not a new question. But that's the first question I'm interested in. I'm going to try to relate it to things going on in Egypt. Second question, which kind of to me follows from this, and I'll try to make clear how it follows in a few minutes. Does a constitution or a constitutional settlement, depending on how you want to think about it, create a more peaceful and secure and free society? So when a constitution results from, or some sort of constitutional outcome results from a revolutionary period, does that actually lead to a better society? Well, in part it can, especially if it brings warring groups together, conflicting parties, ethnic groups, what have you, and there's lots of evidence of this that it can help move a process forward, but there's also, I think, really good evidence to say that when a constitution, when something gets put on paper and even when people sign off on it, that's not the end of the revolutionary process. That's not the end of the chaotic process. Because interpreting and debating constitutions and fighting over them is a continuation sometimes of a revolution and is, in fact, a continuation of politics. So I don't think constitutions actually end things, but they certainly do something. So I want to think about what it is that they actually do. And then, related to these two, following these two, and more specific to the case that I want to talk about today, so kind of what's going to happen in Egypt? Will the Egyptian revolution, and I'll talk about kind of similar to what Adham was saying about how we understand revolution, and I would say there's a revolution going on. Does it lead to greater security? Does it lead to greater liberty? And in the particular case of Egypt, what's going to happen? Now, I'm not going to be a meteorologist and predict the weather for you on this one, because I think that's always dangerous, not just in the Middle East, but anywhere. But just to give some kind of guidelines about maybe where we're trying to, where things might go, okay, the direction things might go. So before I get to some of the specific terms and some of these specific concepts, try to answer, let me give you a kind of brief what my answer is to some of these questions. So kind of some of the boilerplate answers are, yes, revolutions create more liberty, certainly in the moments they're happening. So when a revolution breaks out, that is this great moment of liberty and freedom. So yes, revolutions actually create more liberty. But in fact, you know, this is the lame academic answer, but they also create more insecurity. So they do both. They create insecurity, they create freedom. They tend not to create a lot of security, but I'm going to talk about how we understand security in a couple of minutes. More importantly, in answer to the second question, can a constitution actually bring about greater liberty and greater security? I do think it can. The only way it can, though, in my view, is if the constitution has the right form, that is, if it says these rights are protected, there's a check and balance, there's all these kind of things. But more important than all that, if a constitution arises from what I call, or what others have called, constituent power, and that is, in most modern political orders today, the people. If it comes from its legitimacy, any constitution's legitimacy relies upon the voice of the people being able to articulate it and bring it into action. And also feeling connected to it. And this is quite important for more recent developments, not just in the Middle East, but around the world. There's been this kind of growth in people who are interested in going around the world and helping other countries write their constitutions so they tick all the boxes and are nice and liberal and protect everybody's rights in the right way. But oftentimes that doesn't quite go along with what the people themselves want. Now there's a real difficulty in identifying who the people are, and the concept of who the people are is constantly going to be changing and up to contestation. But the overall point I want to get to, if you can remember one thing from this talk, it's that constitutions do bring both liberty and security if they are able to channel that constituent power. If they can take that power, and it's a very powerful force, as we saw in Tahrir Square and elsewhere, if they can take that force and channel it into something productive that people consider to be legitimate. So that's my big story that I'll try to weave together over the course of the next half hour or so. Okay, so let me try to do this, to talk about this through a couple of different terms and a little bit of history. So the first term is going to be security. And actually what I want to talk about is the dilemma of security versus liberty and how you balance those two things. Now security, if you study international relations, I know some of you here study international relations, security is a very contested term, and it means lots. You know, normally we think security just means somebody's not going to hurt me. But, you know, obviously security means lots more than that, and there's lots of debates about securitization and lots of cool words like that that your tutors may have thrown around in the past. But, you know, security, there is a kind of basic meaning, which is I'm safe to walk the streets and nobody's going to mug me. And, you know, I can get through my day and I can be paid a livable wage and I can feed my family, etc. Okay? So that's the kind of basic idea of security. And what's interesting is, in this post kind of revolutionary situation, again, I'm going to focus on Egypt because that's the case I'm going to look most at. There's lots of things that look like, well, in this post-revolutionary situation, it's not very secure, that actually security has kind of gone out the window. I mean, the most recent thing, you know, was last week, I guess, was the riots by these ultras, the football fans, basically, in Port Said, leaving 74 people dead, and there's lots of debate on what happened, but, you know, that's kind of a breakdown of security when people get killed in a football match. I mean, you know, it's like Glasgow. No, I'm just kidding. It's not like Glasgow. Just kidding. Joking about that one. I can make the same joke about Cleveland, Ohio, where I'm from, since I'm here. So, you know, but that seems like a breakdown in security. Then other people who get worried about regional security, they think, oh, the Muslim Brotherhood's in charge. They're going to leave the peace treaty with Israel. It's going to create insecurity in the region. And then even, you know, greater insecurity in the world. The Middle East will be this cauldron. It'll be chaos. So you do have these kind of voices saying it's becoming more insecure, and it is in a number of ways. It really is, I think, in some ways insecure. There's a lot of insecurity. And this is often posed against, well, the pre-revolutionary period seemed to be very secure and stable. You had Hosni Mubarak, the pharaoh, he's been in charge for years, nothing's changing, the military keeps everything under control. Seems very secure, right? And it is secure in a way, right? I mean, there was a certain amount of security. But it's not, I don't think, the security that arose from the regime or the political system. And I'll give you one example to demonstrate, a personal example. So I taught, as mentioned, I taught at AUC at the American University of Cairo for a few years, from 1996 to 2000. And you know, I loved it. It was a great, great place to be. I loved living there. But so I had one experience of insecurity. I'll give you my insecurity experience. So I one day went to this neighborhood called Zamalek, which is kind of a wealthier neighborhood in Cairo. So it's very nice. And I was going to the butcher there to get I don't know what I was getting. But I came out of the butcher's, and some guy comes up to me and throws tea on the back of my leg. And then he's shaking my trousers like this, and I'm going, what is this? For some reason, my superhero instincts kicked in, and I realized he was mugging me, because he carefully took my wallet out of my pocket while he was doing this. So, and, you know, I'm a big, loud American, white guy, you know, obviously a good target for somebody to mug. But I realized this was happening, and so, I don't know how this came out, I grabbed the guy before he walked away. I said, give me my wallet back right now, in my fumbling Arabic, and I'm not going to try to say it now. And he understood me, and surprisingly, he stopped, and he smiled, and he handed me my wallet back. Okay? Now, weird. I know. This is weird, and I'm not going to make the story too long because I've got more substantive things to say, but the story has an interesting thing about security to it. So for some reason, so then he walks away thinking this is done, and I'm like, this isn't done, damn it, you just took my wallet. So I'm running after him, literally running after him with a bag of meat in my hand, and I feel like an idiot now telling the story. But I'm running after him, and he gets away from me eventually after me running, and there's a lot of yelling, and it's Cairo, so there's a lot of yelling, and other people are yelling, and it's really fun and exciting. But this is really a true story, I'm making this up. And so I'm yelling to the police. I'm like, police, Mr. Short, get over here, you know. And they're all just kind of standing around looking at me like this, you know, not like, you know. And either they were in on this because it was a, you know. And I don't mean to say that the whole system is corrupt or anything. Because what happens then is, three other guys who are not part of the state grab the guy and bring him back to me, who are just regular Egyptians, and they're like, we don't let this happen in Egypt. This is terrible, you know. And they're by the, and I was like, well, just let him go. He gave me the wallet back. But then they sat me down. I don't want to be jailed in Egypt. I don't want anybody to go there at that period. And so then, but then they sit me down and they're buying me tea, and you know, they're really like, this should never happen in Egypt. This is not normal. We don't do this to people. And so the point about security is, it was not the government that was providing me security there. The police were standing there just looking at me, may well have been in cahoots with the guy trying to mug me. But it was a kind of set of social norms. What was very clearly articulated to me, like, you are secure because we don't want this kind of thing to happen to people. Now, maybe they're looking at me as a potential tourist and they don't want to lose tourism income or whatever, but the point is there were social norms that kicked in there that created security more so than any kind of official regime-imposed security, okay? And again, I'm not making this story up, it's a true story, but what I'm going to get to, this again connects to this issue of constituent power. In this particular instance, the security that supposedly existed in Egypt in this moment was not the security provided by Hosni Mubarak. It was not the security provided by the security services. And there's actually a great quote from a piece I just read where someone describes Egypt prior to the revolution as a securocratic state in which the only interaction the people had with the government was through the security services. And I think that's probably apt for a number of people. So again, my experience is, as a Westerner, as someone living in Egypt, is not the normal one for most people who are in Egypt. And I think that gives you a clue that there was a kind of security, but it wasn't even a security that lacked a certain amount of liberty. I don't even think there was a real security in place before. So now, are we going to have more security in the post-revolutionary period? Maybe, maybe. So let me kind of now think about with you a little bit about revolutions and about constitutions and how that may lead to some security. Okay. So what is a revolution? So Adham gave us, a nice schematic from Charles Tilly and from others, kind of theories of revolution. I would say a little different. I think there's some interesting things to say about revolutions, particularly as they pertain to changes not just in political orders, but the kind of classic revolutions, Bolshevik Revolution in Russia, French Revolution, were wider societal revolutions. They're bigger changes in the societal norms as opposed to just in political regime change. You know, as compared to, let's say, an American Revolution, that wasn't exactly a kind of broad-scale revolution in the same way that the French and Russian was. So you can kind of have a scale, and I should have audio visuals, but you can have a kind of scale where you have more extreme, that kind of full-scale, both political, social revolution, all the way to what would be more of a coup d'etat, okay? You know, just a simple change of regime, maybe inaugurated by the military. And I think I would argue that there's a kind of revolutionary scale there. There's revolutions that can exist along that scale. And what I want to mention are the three revolutionary periods in Egypt. The 1919 revolution, 1952, free officers movement that led to a wider revolution, and then the more recent events today. And I think some people might argue that, for instance, the free officers movement in the 50s, led by Nasser and others, that's not really a revolution. That initially is really just a coup d'etat, and then it leads to maybe some kind of early changes, but not a true, because it's just a reimposition of a particular political order. But I do think, as Adham was mentioning, there is a real revolutionary spirit that was sweeping throughout not just the Arab world, but throughout the developing world at the time, and that was part. Those changes were part of that bigger set of changes. Okay, so what I'm going to say today is that there are these three revolutions, and that they are quite important, particularly as they connect to this issue of constitution. So I'm going to give you a quick, just a 2 minutes on each of the revolutions. Because I'm not a historian, so I may get some of the exact details wrong. I don't think so, but just want to mention a couple things about the revolutions and then turn to more about this question, how they do or don't lead to constitutional change. Okay, so the first one, and I'm not sure if anybody's talked about this so far today, but the first one is this: the change, the revolutionary change in 1918, 1919, 1920. And this results from primarily the British leaving Egypt, but that's not all that this was about. Now, and maybe this is what Andy Williams talked about this morning, you know, the British been occupiers of Egypt since the mid-19th century, have been invested in various ways prior to that, even though Egypt was formally part of the Ottoman Empire, the British effectively control the political order. So as World War I comes to a close, though, Egyptian nationalism is really growing, and it's something that people are embracing. And they're, you know, obviously Egypt has been a political entity for a long time, but there's a lot of rapid change happening, very exciting change. And people are embracing this. So right as World War One ends, and in part it's also connected to kind of larger discourses, the self-determination movements in Europe, Wilsonianism, various things that are going on, but there is a kind of one that's emerging from within Egypt as well. I don't want to say this is the result of changes. Some people argue that it's because of Woodrow Wilson or whatever that various states picked up this kind of nationalism, but I don't think that's necessarily the case here. So in November 1918, a delegation of Egyptians goes to the British High Commissioner to request a meeting in London to request their own independence, led by Saad Zaghloul, who's kind of the lead politician of the day, the lead kind of nationalist thinker, not thinker, political actor. And while the commissioner was willing to listen to him at first, officials in London were not that interested and didn't care so much for this, and it made them very nervous for lots of reasons. And as a result, Zaghloul is arrested in March of 1919 and put in jail, which leads to a set of huge riots breaking out throughout Cairo. People are you know, this not exactly the same, but kind of what we were seeing in the last year. You know, there's this real strong constituent power that is directed primarily at the British at this time. So it's not directed at their own regime. It's directed primarily at an external one, but turns into a much larger social political movement as well. And this leads to eventually the British agreeing to independence for Egypt in 1922. And something I'm going to talk about in a little bit more detail in a minute, a constitution comes about in 1923, okay? Which lasts in some ways up until 1950s. So that's the one revolution. Okay, and I want to talk about a few other things about that one in a minute, but I just want to highlight the other revolutions, just ones you probably know a little bit more about. So the next one is, as you know, 1952, what's called the Free Officers Movement, some mid-level military people, led in part, although I think if you read about the various people involved, you know, it was led by Nasser, but there was also lots of people, there was lots of contesting personalities, very strong personalities involved in the Free Officers Movement. But this emerges from largely, I mean, there's lots of reasons. There's the social problems, the wealth problems, but in large part, it's the kind of direct cause, you could say, is the loss in 1948 in the kind of the wars against Israel or the emerging state of Israel and the failure, as many of the military saw, the failure of their political leadership to enable them to really kind of go full force and to fight where they wanted to. So this leads to this very kind of quiet but very quick revolutionary moment. And really it begins as a coup d'etat. In July 1952, the free officers basically surround the palace, they topple the king, exile him. They created various kinds of, which I'll talk about in a minute, various kinds of political systems to begin with, and they're not exactly clear what the formal political process is going to be, and there's lots of to-ing and fro-ing. This one tends not to be as much from driven by that large-scale constituent power of the people. I think Nasser was able to tap into when his voice was able to be found, and he really became the spokesperson and the leader. He then kind of helps create the people, creates that constituent power in a way. But what brings about that initial revolutionary moment is not so much this power of the people. It seems to arise from something slightly different. But revolutions evolve and change, and so as it does evolve and change, the people become much more important. But there, it's not a kind of people rioting and people protesting in the streets and individuals kind of coming out and speaking with their own voice. It really is more of a directed kind of revolutionary process, you might say. And we can talk about that in the questions if you have questions about that. The final revolutionary moment, obviously, is the one that's happened beginning on January 25th of 2011 and continuing up until today. I think what's one of the most ironic things is, and I had forgotten this and I was just reading for last week to prepare for today, that the first protest breaks out on Police Day, which is the irony of this is quite incredible. You know, that it's a day that they were kind of celebrating the police, and there was this big party for the leaders of the police, I think in one of the big hotels or something, while these revolutions are breaking out. So the irony of a kind of security forces, in a sense, being celebrated at the same time that people are hitting the streets is, I think, quite interesting and quite telling. So over the course of the last year, we've had, and what's really amazing about this revolution, there's been this effort to kind of control the people at various moments throughout, but people keep breaking those boundaries, okay? And that's a good or a bad thing, depending on your perspective. I mean, this makes people nervous. And to be honest with you, if I was living in Egypt, if I was Egyptian, not even as a Westerner, let's say I had a family and I had a job and stuff. You know, when you get older, like me, and you have kids, you know, you start to get nervous about big radical change. It makes you a little bit, and that there's a kind of inherent conservatism that comes about from having a job and having to feed people and all sorts of stuff. So I can understand the worries that some have had. And you did see this in the beginning with, you know, the protests happening and then other groups kind of the anti-protests, and some people, they're thugs hired by the regime. But I think, you know, they were probably hired by the regime, but there was probably people who really weren't so sure they wanted things changing so much. And you can understand why that might have been. Okay, so you've got this revolutionary moment that's been going on for the last year. Let me turn now to some constitutional developments that have happened as a result of these revolutions, okay? And this is where I'll continue the three stories and then sum things up, okay? And I think this is what gets lost, and this is what for many people seems kind of boring, is, you know, it's not the excitement of hitting the streets and the revolutionary process and what have you. It's the boring stuff of sitting down and trying to draft the constitutional agreement and writing out how we're going to structure our institutions. And I think this is where I'd encourage you to pay attention to what's happening. And there's lots of resources. You don't have to, you know, have to read Arabic. There's lots of stuff that's translated. You can get really good details on what's going on right now in Egypt and probably in other countries as well. But Egypt in particular, there's lots of stuff about the Constitution that's available that you can take a look at. So let me just say one thing about this idea of constituent power before I tell the stories of the three revolutions. So as I mentioned, constituent power is this the kind of basis by which people create something anew. They create a new constitution. It's basically the power, as we say today, the power of the people. Okay, that's what the constituent power really is. And constituent power gives legitimacy to any political order. If you don't have that link to that constituent power, the order quickly becomes illegitimate and people either seethe underneath it or they break out and it results in further revolutions. And there's an interesting thing, and I'm not going to get too technical here, but there's interesting recent literature on what's called the paradox of constitutionalism. And the paradox is the following. On the one hand, you have this powerful constituent force that creates new systems. But on the other hand, you have this kind of what's called the constitutional form, that is the written document that creates things like rights and a legislature and a judiciary and an executive, electoral processes, parliamentary structures, all the boring stuff which is necessary to govern a system, but it sometimes doesn't go well with this constituent power. The paradox is you're always trying to make sure the constituent power gets channeled into these productive forces, but it doesn't always work because the constitutional form halts that constituent power in a moment in time and prevents it from changing and evolving. And that's the real, I think, paradox that's happening. And it's a paradox we've seen, I think, in every one of the revolutions that have happened. I don't have too much time here, so I want to make sure I at least tell a story about each one of these. So, let me first start with the 1919 revolution, okay? Okay, so as I said, 1919, the British kind of, there's this, the British kind of agree to leave. They formally leave, although never really leave until the 50s, but in 1922, and what the Egyptian political elites do at that point is appoint what the equivalent of a constitutional commission, a group of people to come together to write the constitution, which is drawn largely from kind of not necessarily Western educated, but those who have been influenced by ideas of kind of liberal political thought of that time. Okay, kind of Wilsonianism, those kind of ideas, self-determination, ideas of rights and those kind of things. So those who are on this commission come from that group within society, okay? And what's interesting is that the two most active political parties, the National Party and the WAFD Party, both strongly object to the commission. So the commission was kind of appointed both by the British and also by the government of the day, which is linked to the king, who had been previously the Sultan. And so the two most powerful political parties are strongly, in a sense, objecting to the members of the commission. And they're the ones who say, well, this commission doesn't really represent us. It's going to be imposing on us a kind of political system that we're not, that doesn't quite go along with who we are. So you have this initial kind of concern. So while this is going on, there's debates going on. October 1922, a draft constitution actually gets proposed. So they've got one in their hands now. Then you have objections coming from the king, who, as I said, was previously the Sultan and now is the king. And he says, well, this gives too much power to the parliament. I need to ensure security. I need to ensure that the nation is kept under control. And so you can't let parliament pass law without me. You can't allow the parliament to create the government, which would be, let's say, the Westminster model as we have here in the United Kingdom. Instead, the parliament, or the government, that is the prime minister and the cabinet, should be appointed by the king. So you have this ongoing wrangling going back and forth. Now, elections eventually do get held according to the constitutional provisions. The WAFT is the predominant party in power, and yet still, even though they're in parliament, they don't get to control who's the prime minister and what constitutes the government. Okay, a lot of kind of detail here, which is maybe not all necessary. What's important to emphasize, though, out of this little vignette about the Constitution is you had basically people drafting a constitution that looked like we would want a constitution to look like. It protected rights, it had a kind of system of some kind of checks and balances, but those who were, there was a huge kind of, and it didn't lead to the kind of large-scale riots that resulted in 1919, but there was a number of people hitting the streets objecting to this, and a constant political debate about whether or not this was the right constitutional settlement. Okay, so it seems in this case, whereas constituent power helped inaugurate and create the possibility for a constitution, it wasn't channeled or harnessed, and it wasn't turned into the constitution that most people wanted. Now again, who's most people? Who are the people that count? Obviously there were some people that were happy with this constitution. That's something that's worth debating and thinking about. Let me jump to the next constitution, after the 1952 revolution. So as I said, after 1952, the free officers bring a new kind of political system into place. And one of the things that they were most interested in, and Adham read the little brief section from Nasser's Philosophy of the Revolution, was a real kind of social revolution. They were very interested in agrarian law changes, was one thing that became a very specific thing, how to redistribute land, how to ensure that wealth was not concentrated in a few hands. So there was, not initially, but eventually it became a much stronger social revolutionary movement, something you would think maps onto this constituent power, right? And this is where I think, as I mentioned before, Nasser in particular was in a sense constructing a people. He was a very articulate, very charismatic figure who was able to convince people and tap into their frustrations with the current social order and help convince them that, yes, you need a new constitutional system that will enable you to, that will enable wealth to be redistributed, really. That was a big part of the eventual, from the beginning of the free option movement, that evolved into the larger political change. Now, I'll tell you one little vignette about this constitutional. I mean, there was a constitution that eventually came about in 1956, so after 4 years of various kinds of political debates and political structures, did create a republic that on paper looked great, you know, but as it worked itself out, was not so great. It really concentrated power in the hands of Nasser, not just Nasser, but the Revolutionary Command Council and others, and really gave, in the name of security, gave them much more power. And one thing that probably, not the only thing, but there was an assassination attempt against Nasser in 1954 that led to the crushing of the Muslim Brotherhood and led to lots of political restrictions. So this was a kind of, my security is threatened, we need to crack down, we can't let this constituent power get out of control. We can't let too many people be involved in politics. That's too dangerous. That was the argument that was being made at the time. One interesting fact, though, and again, this is, there's And I didn't know this until I read this book by this guy, Khaled Mohi al-Din, who was one of the free officers and was actually probably the most leftist of the free officers. A great little book called Memories of a Revolution. And he's trying to settle, he was trying to settle scores against Sadat and various people, so there's lots of internal politics in the book. But one interesting thing about the book, because he was one of the more progressive members of the revolutionary system, is he pointed out there was one guy who was named al-Sanhouri, who was probably the most important Egyptian legal theorist of the 20th century. He helped kind of draft the Egyptian legal code. Actually, he had a lot to say about international law. He's a really interesting legal figure who has not been translated enough into English. If somebody, a good Arabic speaker, wants to help me translate stuff, I'd love to have you help me with that. Interesting thing that Mohi al-Din points out in his book is how Sanhouri, who we see as someone and who was very interested in things like protecting rights and creating a constitution that had a strong judiciary, all the things, again, we would want in a very good political order, a good liberal political order, was at the same time very wary about the agrarian law reforms that Nasser and others were pushing. And like a number of what Mohi al-Din calls constitutional experts, really strongly encouraged that there not be too much redistribution of wealth in society. So you have this interesting moment where this one guy who is a very important constitutional thinker, liberal political thinker, comes in and is again wants to control that constituent power. You don't want to give money to too many people, you don't want to give wealth to too many people, they become dangerous, they start to riot, you lose control. Okay? Again, in some ways, I don't want to be too sympathetic to this position, but there is a, you can understand, you know, if people are out rioting all the time, and you know, you can understand that there's a real concern there about insecurity in the society. But I think what you can see is over time, the Egyptian system developed from the 50s up until just last year, wealth did get concentrated in very few hands, particularly after the Sadat reforms in the 70s and 80s that opened up the economy to a select few, really, didn't open it up to a wider capitalist system, really concentrated wealth, and so, again, constrained that constituent power, constrained the ability of the people to have any say by not enabling them to have any wealth and place in the political and social order. All right, last story. So the last story is obviously the one that we're witnessing now, that's happening right now. Let me highlight a few things about the constitutional debates that have happened in the last year. So after the kind of change, after Mubarak steps down, there's this kind of moment of liberation, excitement. But then people think, okay, we got to get down to the hard facts of making a political system work. So in March 2011, the military proposes what they call 9 constitutional articles in a referendum to the public, okay, which passes something like 70-80% approval, okay, and it's interesting. So these 9 constitutional principles are again ones that sound good. There's one in there about making sure there's a National Security Council that only the military controls, so they got their little point in there. But other than that, all the other things sound good and right, you know. But then, just a few weeks after that, the military then publishes 62 constitutional principles or articles that become the governing document of Egypt. Now, so they turn 9 constitutional principles that were approved in a public referendum, an embrace of that constituent power. Yes, the people have a say, but then turn it into 62 articles. Now, partly that, you know, 9 principles, you can't govern a country with 9 principles. You need a little more detail. But as people started to look at the difference between the 9 and the 62, they noticed that things had changed a little bit. The president continued to have a lot of power. Parliament, not that much power. Still restrictions on who could be president. Still restrictions on parties. Lots of things that didn't quite look like what had been approved in the public referendum. So, now again, this is practical. You have to create a system that governs, and that's okay, but it did create a bit of a problem. So, but what this new system was designed said is that, okay, here's the plan. We're going to have a parliament that's been elected. The parliament will then approve a 100-member constitutional commission. They'll create this. They will then write the constitution. In the meantime, the president will be elected, and then we'll have a fully governing system, which then, once the constitution is elected, the president and the parliament will abide by it. Now, you see a kind of problem here with the timing, right? I mean, you have the parliament creating a constitution, which will then And then you have a president being elected. And then how does the Constitution, then do they have to disband and start all over again? The military has been saying things like, well, not quite. We'll make sure that the system is in place and we're going to play a role in appointing these 100 people. The Constitutional Commission will write the right kind of constitution. And we saw a very direct evidence of this in August of last year when the deputy prime minister said publicly on TV, there are something like, I figure out how many there were, there's a few inviolable constitutional principles that cannot be changed, okay? No matter what parliament says. So, and these again sounded okay. People should have their rights respected, all this other kind of stuff. A good constitutional form. But it was you had a very quick and loud objection from groups like the Muslim Brotherhood, who knew they were going to be the predominant party in parliament and knew that this would tie their hands. There'd be no way they could do anything in contradiction to these inviolable constitutional principles if they actually make their way into the final constitution. All right, so I don't want to go into too much more detail because there's lots of detail that people like me who get excited about constitutions get excited about because it's a little boring. So I'm gonna kind of draw to a close here. And what I want to emphasize, though, and again, these are just kind of snapshots. I'm just pulling some instances out of these three historical periods, a couple points here. But as you can see, these revolutions created these very exciting moments, and the constituent power of the people erupted, and that's great, and that's good. But you also, have the hard task of governing, right? And Max Weber, the famous sociologist, said politics is about the slow boring of hard, something like that. I don't have the phrase right. It's boring and hard, and it takes a lot of work. And that's true. But if you go so far as to turn that kind of, well, it takes a lot of work, we have to make sure everything's secure, we can't allow people on the street, we can't allow chaos, it can't be too, we can't give people too much power, whether that be through their wealth or what have you, because that creates problems, and people do crazy things. And people do crazy things, right? But at the same time, if you constrain that constituent power too much, if you keep it in a box, if you keep squashing it down, you'll never actually have a legitimate political order. Now, the last thing I would say is any kind of political order ever achieve that stable legitimacy? No. I mean, look at countries, look at the Occupy whatever protests that have been going on over the past 2 years. I mean, you see, and these are in kind of, Britain, France, United States, everywhere. I mean, these movements are demonstrating that there's a lack of legitimacy often in any political system. And my favorite political theorist, Hannah Arendt, points out that politics is constantly about this. It's constantly about the kind of, you have a revolution, you create a new system, and then it kind of gets stable, then you have another revolution. So it's this constant cycle of political activism. And this isn't something we should be too worried about and too afraid of. This is actually what politics is about, and it's something we should celebrate and be happy with. My only hope is that in Egypt, while they need to create a political order, they need to write a constitution, that hopefully that constitution is, as I said, able to channel that constituent power and turn it into something that creates a real, viable political order. Okay. Questions? I know I'm holding you for the end of the day. Going to get a drink, so maybe there's no questions. Yes, in the back.
In terms of the whole debate as to what is the constituent power, could we argue that its best manifestation would be civil society, despite the fact that, of course, civil society is a very contested thing itself? What I'm looking at is, what do you think is the role of civil society right now in Egypt, particularly given that organizations like the April 6th movement or many women rights organizations have submitted many proposals for constitutional changes, which however, none of them have been implemented. And in many cases, these groups are very reluctant to further participate in politics. I'm wondering what are your thoughts?
Yeah, that's a great question, and this actually captures one of the not quite the dilemma I put originally, but you know, one of the good things about what I think, and I'm a big believer in and I, you know, sometimes here at St. Andrews, people aren't so much, but I'm a big believer in traditional liberalism. I'm a traditional liberal. I like my rights to be protected. Don't, you know, back off my house, back off my stuff, leave me alone. That's what liberalism comes down to, really. But one of the things is, particularly, let's say, women's rights in a place like Egypt. You know, there has, you know, women's rights have been an issue, obviously, and for lots of reasons. Now, on the one hand, you had, in the previous system, a certain percentage of every party had to elect a certain number of women, appoint a certain number of women into the parliament. You had to have women, the president appointed a certain number of women to the consultative council, to the shura. So women had a formal kind of political set of rights in the previous system. And some people are saying, well, now with the new system, you know, certain voices may not be heard. And so the kind of this constituent power may be overwhelmingly male right now, for instance, right? And that's going to be a problem for women, okay? Maybe, okay? Now, it's also the case, though, there's lots of evidence that people who were hitting the streets and protesting were women, and that they're not going to back down simply because the predominant discourse is male right now. I can't see that happening right now. Now, then there's the other question of the formal role of some of these groups, which you identified as civil society, NGOs, women's groups, and all of that should, all those groups, in my view, should play a very strong role in any kind of political dialogue. Is it better that they're kind of formally recognized and maybe funded from outside sources and all those kind of dilemmas then start to emerge, you know, about, well, is this a Western set of imposed rights upon a particular side? I don't think it is, but, you know, that becomes an issue, certainly, in any one of these kind of debates about what the political future is going to be. But I think one of the things I would be cautious about is just seeing officially recognized English-speaking groups, NGOs, as civil society. That often is what civil society becomes for us when we're sitting here, let's say, in the St. Andrews and observing it. You know, but civil society, those groups may be representative of civil society, but we have to make sure we're hearing all elements of civil society. And people who are really poor don't have any official recognition. They don't have any voice. And that's what happens oftentimes is you get these nice foreign-funded official groups. And I don't know the particular groups you're referring to. So I would just be cautious about some of that discourse to ensure that as many voices can be heard as possible. Okay, but that's also the dilemma of who are the people. You know, the people can be constructed as Nasser constructed the people in a particular way, or the people can be just something that emerges. So you really have to be careful there. Yes?
Yeah, thank you very much for a really fascinating theoretical lecture. I just want to ask the question about this, how consequent power can translate into the order, into good constitution in societies with weak democratic traditions.
Yeah.
And this paternalistic political culture. How can we find this golden middle in that situation?
I don't think Egypt has a weak democratic culture. I don't think it has a paternalistic culture. I mean, you know, I'm always very nervous about those kind of claims. They just don't sound right to me. You know, one of the interesting things about Egypt is that it had the strongest judiciary in the entire Arab world prior to the revolution. I mean, the judiciary was very vigorous, very active. So I think, does that mean it was democratic? No, because judiciaries are often are very undemocratic institutions. But they are institutions that ensure rights get protected as far as possible in particular political orders. I'm not worried about that. I think, you know, there is a kind of, there's an ethos within Egyptian society and any society that wants kind of political rights protected, wants, you know, public participation and all those kind of things. I don't think there's very few people in the world who want to be under a jackboot. I mean, that's not really, this maybe as a weak human nature argument, but I'd be surprised if any people really, this is not a George Bush argument, like they all want freedom. I don't mean that. But there's something to that that I'm a believer in, that there is something about everybody wants to be recognized politically and have a voice. And I think that's really what and I think in Egypt there has been for a long time. You know, this is not the first riot that you've had, any set of revolutionary protests you've had in Egypt. They've been going on for a long time. So people have been stepping up to the plate and saying, this is not the way things should be, and we're not going to allow things this way. So I think that that ethos exists already. Yeah.
Thanks a lot for the historical background. So I have a question regarding Egypt as a case study. We're talking about constitution, right? The constitution, you highlighted how Abdel Nasser created this mentality and put information in the minds of the people and wrote or had his constitution in 56. Prior to that, Sanhuri, as you mentioned, one of the biggest believers in liberal thinking and democracy, wrote a constitution and it was put in the drawers at some point.
Yeah.
Later in 71, Sadat had his own new constitution that was written, and it also was putting information in the mindset of the people and writing a different constitution than the people wanted. So now, how can we guarantee those voices heard, and especially that we don't have a good historical incident of enlightened leadership in Arab world or Egypt specifically that is going to include all those groups in the new constitution?
Yeah, great. That's a great question. That's the dilemma now, absolutely. And, you know, so, I mean, I could be theoretical because I'm a political theorist and say, yeah, they should all be included. I mean, how those voices get included is, I think, very very complicated. And it goes back to the first question about, you know, what groups should be involved. I guess what I would say, so practically, I think it will be crucial who these 100 people are who get appointed, okay? If 100 people writing one document, if you've ever been in an academic committee meeting, you know that's, if anything, academics can't do anything, so I hope they're not academics. I hope they're actually people who are able to turn ideas into action. I hope they don't all agree. I hope there is a kind of vigorous conversation amongst those 100. Some of those 100 are going to be strongly influenced by the military. I wouldn't be surprised if there are military people who get put on the commission. I hope those people, there's people who are drawn from kind of the legal background. I hope there's people who are drawn from, who are Islamicists. You know, I think it will be important to have as many voices as possible in that conversation. Now the trick then is obviously to produce a document out of that. I think one of the things that does, so the model many people have in mind is the American Constitutional Convention, where you have these very radically different views sit down in this very hot summer, and they had to figure out what's the American Constitution going to be. And, you know, there was this crucial divide between the slaveholders and the non-slaveholders. And they fudged it, okay? And the fudge didn't work. And, you know, you had 80 years, 70 years later, you had a civil war that had to resolve it. So that's maybe what's going to happen. I don't know. I mean, but in answer to the practical question is, what I'm worried about, and maybe be, I don't know if it's behind your question, is that if you have somebody, an enlightened leader, come in and say, well, this is what it should say. Well, yeah. I mean, I think I know what it should say. But if somebody tells them what it should say, then you've got problems because then voices aren't being heard. So again, it'll be really interesting, and I'm going to be wanting to pay careful attention to all the biographies of the people who get put on that commission. If somebody wants a great research project to kind of, that would be a wonderful research project to, who are these people? What are their backgrounds? What do they want to do? What happens over the course of this thing? I mean, just to be a fly on the wall in that room forever how long it takes will be really, I think, a fascinating process. So I don't have an answer to you practically how it's going to happen, but I guess it would be telling you and others to listen and to pay attention to who is in that conversation and how that plays itself out. Yes?
I just wanted to say something about your point about how the new regime needs to channel this institutional power. Can we just stand up? How it has to channel the constitutional power back into the new regime.
Mm-hmm.
I was in Egypt over Christmas, and I feel that this is something that will be very hard to happen for two reasons. I recall one moment, I went there with an American friend of mine, and we went to Tahrir despite our parents, don't go, it's dangerous, this isn't that. And I remember him saying, as we were walking around, we were both feeling quite, like, as if we're kind of offending by your presence, the people there. So I remember him asking, and there were burning things around. Why are they burning everything? So I feel that the main issue with channeling the constitutional power back into the regime, there are two. First of all, I feel the people that started the revolution are different from the people that will vote and support the regime. So the revolution started because of some aims that the people that are voting for the new regime do not realize, they don't know, they don't associate themselves with them, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
And second of all, there's a large amount of people, and Cairo is a massive place, I'm sure you know that, that do not know what it is to reconstruct the democracy. They don't know how to be part of that. And you see that with the protests now. Something comes up, like the 9 clauses, then people revolt against it, then something else comes up, then more violence, and more. They themselves don't know how to channel their aims into a constitution. And also, the most dangerous of all, I feel, there's so many people that don't even care. People care about the changes in their social life more than who is at the government. And if it's, they don't care about the name, if it's a democracy, if it's a monarchy, if whatever it is. And there's a lot of people that say, since there's no difference in our social life, to us it doesn't really matter. I'm just going to finish by saying that I find this the most dangerous, because in 1973, and you said that all revolutions are more or less the same, there was a dictatorship in Greece that fell. And everyone was very happy, and they were like, now we're having a democracy. And we didn't realize how nothing really changed, and all we got was a democracy that's a democracy in the name. And you see, 30 years later, how we got 70% absence from elections, how we got a regime, a constitution falling apart because of that, because of a dictatorship turning into democracy. That's democracy in the name, because right. There are no people to know how to support it.
Right. Yeah, you didn't know Germans would be telling you what to do when you write that. that's the kind of concern I'm talking about. Yes, there is a, you know, people who are, most people don't care about voting and being who's, whether their country's called. They want to make sure they can eat and that their children are happy and that their children can get educated and that they can be, you know, go to a football match without them being killed. So, you know, those are the kind of things obviously people care about. But, you know, I think most people are smart enough to realize that if, you know, that North Korea is different than, you know, whatever. I mean, there's, people are not as dumb as you think. You know, people do, especially in revolutionary moments like that, they're out in the streets, they're protesting, it's crazy, things get heated, they can't control themselves, and that leads to chaos, right? When I talk about it, I want that constituent power to be channeled, you know, through things like referenda, through things like parliamentary elections, which not everybody's going to be involved with, but the more people you can get involved, the better. And I think when things are articulated in a way that people can grasp and that people can connect with and that makes sense, I think you will find that there are people are smart enough to govern themselves. I mean, I'm a pretty strong believer in that, you know. I guess this could be just a difference of opinion we have. I'm not sure that there's dumb people everywhere, you know. But smart people aren't always the best rulers. So, you know, I mean, it's not that you want real super smart people, you want good people. So, you know, usually those things go together, not always, you know. So, look at some of your tutors, they're not here.
This next one's going to have to be our last question.
Maybe just one more? All right, that's it then, huh?